Real people, real radio.
Initiating the truth frequency.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you guys for tuning in once again. This is, of course, the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. Today is the 27th day of January, and we are live just like we are every day, Monday through Friday. My name is JD, and it is straight up top of the hour. The show has just begun. This is the first segment today. We always do the news in the first segment. All of you guys, I'm sure, know this already. But since we do have new listeners tuning in all the time, I try and give the diatribe here over and over and over again. So just so you guys know, if you're a new listener, this is what we do every day. We spend 2 hours live. We go over all of the pertinent information from around the world and in your neck of the woods during the first hour, bringing you guys all the pertinent headlines. And you can find all those headlines at redpillreports.com. If you go into the show section, you'll also see who the guest is for that day, and then you'll be able to follow along as I usually fail pretty miserably to try and get through as much news as I'd like to every day. There's just so much stuff happening around the world. It's just a little overwhelming sometimes. And I want to apologize. Yesterday, I was firing, I'd say, at a 1 to 10 scale at about a 3, and I have, with the help of quite a bit of coffee today, cranked it up to about 8. So I should be able to get both my brain and my mouth in conjunction at least a few times today. So hopefully you guys will appreciate that. I want to let you guys know, all of you kids that are hanging out in the chat room, I love you guys. Love you guys for being in there. It's so nice to see you guys having conversations about things that are going on. And I'll tell you, yesterday's show with Greg Morse, we talked quite a bit about the mortgage scandal again and tried to really bring it home for people so that they could understand that your mortgage, the people out there listening right now, your mortgage is likely compromised right now. And we had a lot of activity in the chat room, a lot of good questions being asked and a lot of good interaction, which makes me believe that we're doing what it is that we want to do here at Red Pill, which is reaching out to all of you and providing a forum so that you guys can get all this fantastic information that we're trying to share with you guys, because I'm not that smart. So my goal is to basically just step out of the way and bring you guys outstanding guests. And so today, like every other day, will be no exception to that rule. And today, Simon Black is going to be joining us all the way from Chile, we hope. He has a website called sovereignman.com, and it is really, really fantastic. He also does a newsletter that you can sign up for. But he talks about essentially the life of an expat and an international permanent traveler, how to become free in the truest sense of the word, how to deal with your finances and things like that. Ideas on good banks that you can keep your money in that might not be quite as illiquid as some of the banks here in the States. Some ideas on foreign currencies that you might want to be holding also. So really, really good information and a great guy. Definitely looking forward to talking to him at the 11 o'clock hour. And for those of you in a different time zone, that is 1 hour from Rat Meow. So again, Simon Black will be on today. Tomorrow, Water Lily is going to be joining us. She, of course, is one of the administrators, one of the mods over at Scene.is, which is a private social networking platform, very similar to Facebook, except much better than Facebook in that they are not going to be asking you for your phone number. They're not going to be controlling the news that you see in your feed. It's just a much simpler way for really good quality communication. And Water Lily also is a big proponent of encryption. Obviously, she works with Chris Kitsey over at Seen and Unseen. So encryption, not something that's lost on Water Lily. And again, you know, we keep seeing these articles coming out from around the world now saying Europol wants to have an international cyber crime fighting unit, and David Cameron coming on TV saying that encryption itself is the enemy. We can't give these terrorists any place to hide. And, you know, I always get concerned about stuff like that because there's a, you know, there's a potential that, the people might be putting things into play that are good in the meantime. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it might be a good thing to break down some encryption and make sure that the terrorists are not going to win or whatever. But at the same time, you always have to understand that when you create these systemic rules, you can't always be accountable for whoever is going to take over later. So great. You know, we may make these rules. We might ban encryption and everybody might love Barack Obama and whoever's in charge of the, you know, the federal cybersecurity wing. But, at the end of the day, once Barack is replaced by somebody, you know, horrible like Hillary, who knows what she would do with that capability. So it's not just a concept of, allowing these people to have capability. It's just bearing in mind, you know, who can use this capability later on. And I'm very anti the anti-encryption thing. And I'm sure that Water Lily will have a lot to talk about with that tomorrow. And then I got to tell you as well, another high water mark this week is going to be Thursday's show. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is going to be on the show. Talk about a health guru. She is absolutely amazing in terms of just, you all should be very happy that she is out in the world doing what she's doing. But essentially, she planned a little trip to Australia recently, and it wasn't really even at her behest. Somebody asked her to come and do some speaking engagements down there to talk about her anti-vaccination agenda. She has a pretty substantial anti-vaccination stance, as a lot of us do here at Red Pill Reports, and so she was going to come down to Australia to talk about it. Well, a lot of people have kicked up quite a big fuss, and she has she's right now really on the fence about whether or not she's even going to go to Australia because of death threats against her. I mean, we're talking really, really serious stuff here. The anti-vaccination crowd is really fired up right now, but I'll tell you, definitely going to be looking forward to this phone call on Thursday at 11 o'clock Central Time with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She's going to be just absolutely outstanding, and then I'm hoping she'll be a repeat guest, and we can talk a little bit more about natural health and about some of the things that a lot of you guys out there might want to know about. So we're going to talk about that quite a bit on Thursday as well. So again, it's going to be a huge week. I definitely appreciate you guys tuning in. I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate you guys sharing the show with your friends and seeing the interaction in the chat rooms. I will do my best to remember to open up the phone lines in the second hour when Simon is on the show. So if you guys have questions for him, definitely be ready to make that phone call. So, okay, what else is going on in the world? Let's find out because there is a lot of it. And let me just give a quick thumbs up there. Okie dokie here. Let's see. Moving into the international news right now, there is a lot going on. I do have to tell you, too, in the second news segment today, we're going to talk more about the economy. There's been a big thing happening in the economy today. The Dow is way down, ladies and gentlemen, way down right now. No idea why. It's unusual when you see massive moves in the market like that, and there's nobody saying what it's because of, at least from the talking head standpoint. So we'll try and get our minds around that here in the second hour, but I did want to give you a heads up that the economy is going to be on the plate here at the bottom of this first hour. So anyway, let's move on to the international news. Again, lots and lots of stuff going on right now. The ISIS militants have nearly been pushed out of Kobane in Syria by the Kurds and the U.S.-led airstrikes, apparently. So Kurdish fighters, backed by intense U.S.-led airstrikes, pushed the Islamic State group back almost entirely out of the Syrian town of Kobane on Monday. Fantastic news, right? This marks a major loss for the extremists whose hopes for an easy victory dissolved into a bloody, costly siege that seems pretty close to ending in defeat there in Syria right now, which is, you know, obviously a great thing. Fighters on Monday raised a Kurdish flag on a hill in a border town near Turkey that once flew the Islamic State group's black banner. It represents a key conquest both for the embattled Kurds and the U.S. coalition, whose American coordinator had predicted that the Islamic State would impale itself on Kobane. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and senior Kurdish officials said that the Islamic State had been nearly expelled with just some sporadic fighting on the edges of the town there. So that's really good news, I think. If you guys are following this whole Syria, ISIL, Iraq, Israel debacle, it is very confusing. I will absolutely admit that. But it does seem like, at least on the Syrian front, some major progress is being made against ISIS. You guys can, you know, take that for what it's worth right now. But it does seem like at least some progress is being made against ISIS, which is, you know, again, pretty good news as far as I'm concerned. Okay, let's see here. Moving on. Big news out of Greece also. Yesterday we had the exit poll results during the show, but the election of the new anti-austerity government in Greece is now raising questions about how the debt-laden state will satisfy its creditors and citizens weary of cost-cutting measures. So this Alexis Tsipras guy, so he was sworn in as Greece's new prime minister yesterday after forming a coalition with the right-wing independent Greeks party, and he has vowed now to end austerity measures and to renegotiate the terms of Greece's European Union bailout. This is going to be a huge deal. This is potentially going to change the entire tide in terms of the EU, because what we're seeing right now is potentially a popular uprising that has actually been successful, which is, you know, there are a lot of popular uprising groups all over the EU that are demanding ends to austerity, that are demanding a return to their local currencies and things like that. And now one of those groups in a major country like Greece has won. So this is going to set a precedent for other uprising groups around the region. I think that this is going to be, again, just the first grain of sand that we're going to see falling into the bottom of the time clock there. So since 2010, Greece has actually received bailouts totaling a little more than 240 billion euros. In return, the International Monetary Fund, the European Commission, and the European Central Bank demanded tax hikes, a freeze on state pensions, bans on early retirement, and deep cuts in government salaries. So Syriza really was successful because his pledges have been really in the vein of trying to get some of Greece's colossal debt written off and to roll back all these unpopular austerity measures. And that obviously appealed to an exasperated, you know, a large portion of exasperated members of the electorate. So this could jeopardize, as I said, not only Greece's financial system, but their place in the Eurozone initially or overall, because this, as I said, you know, if they want to remove austerity, they want to renegotiate their debt, and the IMF is not going to just allow that to happen. The IMF is pretty heavy-handed when it comes to their loans. And so what is the IMF going to do? Are we going to see sanctions from them, or, you know, in some way, shape, or form, the powers that shouldn't be are going to have to try and put pressure on Greece and on the people there to, you know, punish them for having the audacity to stand up against this draconian system that the EU seems to be under. Again, these are not the people's debts. These are bankers' debts. They're debts that are the result of non-industry. These people create nothing. They do nothing for society. All they do is gamble. And then when they lose, the people have to pay for it. And Greece has really been under the gun for a long time. So I'm really hopeful that this is going to be the first of many uprises across the EU. I'm thinking that, you know, again, if Germany starts realizing just exactly how bad they're doing in terms of the general population there, I think like 3 million Germans right now can't afford to make ends meet. And, you know, I think if I was in Germany, I would be really, really considering strongly getting as far away from the euro as I possibly could. I'm thinking about getting away from the euro just because it's lost so much value in the last few days. It's been ridiculous. But anyway, that I think will be the first of many. I think that we will see the anti-euro five-star movement in Italy potentially get some bolster from this. Probably Podemos movement in Spain as well. Again, a lot of little uprising movements around the world, people trying to get away from these austerity measures, and I think that this thing happening in Greece is going to be a pretty big deal. Again, people are going to follow that example, I think, going forward. Let's see. Russia and Ukraine still kind of not getting along. I guess that's the best way to put it. In a report from Reuters, Russia has blamed Kiev just yesterday for a surge in the fighting in the Ukraine and warned the West that any attempt to increase economic pressure on Moscow would be absolutely destructive blackmail. So again, not nice words being exchanged from Russia and Kiev. But it comes down to the fact that pro-Moscow separatists, backed by what NATO says are Russian troops, have launched an offensive into southeastern Ukraine. And President Barack Obama said Washington was considering all options short of military action to isolate Russia. So again, thoughts coming out of Washington are that we need to become more involved here. And when I get over into the national news, I know that John, for the love of God, McCain had quite a bit to say about getting ground troops over into the Ukraine as well. A Kremlin spokesman actually denied, of course, any Russian involvement in the fighting. And the foreign minister also there in Russia accused the West of whipping up anti-Russian hysteria to justify extended economic sanctions in Moscow. And I think, you know, looking at the two sides of the story, you know, the Kremlin saying we're not doing anything to materially support the people in eastern Ukraine. And then you have the Kiev side that says, you know, there's actually Russian soldiers in the eastern side, and they're attacking our soldiers in Kiev, or at least our soldiers that we've sent from Kiev to try and get Donetsk back under control and things like that. I think you have to look at the whole spectrum and then just fall right in the middle. I think, again, it's very obvious that a lot of people, almost a million people, have been displaced from eastern Ukraine. Many of those people are from Russia. Many of those people have family and friends in Russia. Many of those people with friends and family in Russia served in the Russian military. So obviously they know what they're doing. And how, you know, if a guy who lives on the Russian side of the Ukraine border and he has family in the Ukraine, and all of a sudden his family in the Ukraine is getting stuff dropped on their houses, shells, things like that, what's to stop him from throwing his old uniform on and going over to protect his family? He's going to use the skills that he developed in the Russian military. It doesn't mean that he's working at the behest of the Russian military. It means that he is a trained person and is over there trying to protect his family. And I bet you that there's some of that going on. And I would imagine that that's where most of these rumors come from in terms of the, us versus them mentality. But I guess that's just my own, insight into this, just my own thoughts, because it makes sense to me in reality. But I don't know. What do you guys think? We'll check out the chat room, see what you guys are saying about all of that stuff. People still talking about, I don't know. Anyway, that's what's going on in the Russia and the Ukraine debacle right now. There was a fighter jet crash, a Greek F-16 crashed in Spain yesterday during a NATO exercise, actually killed 10 people, which seems a little tough to me, but 10 people did die Monday after a Greek Air Force F-16 jet crashed at a base in Los Llanos in southeastern Spain. 8 were French military personnel, and 2 were the Greek pilots, according to a senior Spanish defense official. And the jet crashed after takeoff, hitting other planes on the ground, which is why there were so many extra damage to people there. And 21 additional people were injured, according to the statement from the Spanish defense ministry. All of those hurt were French or Italian. So not good there. That's not good when your jets start falling out of the sky, but a NATO exercise gone horribly wrong there, apparently, in Spain. So yeah, that's what happened there. What else is going on? We apparently have right now U.S. counterterrorism operations going on in Yemen. We've talked a little bit about the Yemen president and the parliament essentially stepping down last week after all the Houthi fighters attacked parliament and attacked the presidential compound, stormed it, they were guarding it, they stole a bunch of vehicles. We already all know all about that. But so they stepped down, essentially, and so Yemen is still kind of in chaos right now. And the president came out and said he was very concerned about the fragility of Yemen's central government following their resignation last week. And the U.S.-backed president and the cabinet there, again, you know, these are people that we put into power, so let's just bear that in mind. They have all resigned now. But he does say that it's never been a perfect democracy or an island of stability, so he's not super-duper concerned. But then John, for the love of God, McCain, I'm going to call him that every time from now on because it just flows off the tongue so well. What is John for the love of God, McCain? Well, he says we need more boots on the ground. I know it's a tough thing to say and it's a tough thing for Americans to swallow, but it doesn't mean the 82nd Airborne. It means more Air Force forward controllers, means special forces, means intelligence, and it means other capabilities. So again, he's going to want to put heavily armed and equipped, quote unquote, advisors in Yemen. I imagine right now we've got a pretty substantial drone program going on right now. I know we actually took a couple of people out, quote unquote, terrorists yesterday, even after the parliament and the government has resigned. So not really sure exactly what's going on in Yemen right now or whether or not they're going to bring their stuff back together. But it does seem pretty apparent at this point that the U.S. installing dictatorships in countries that we don't understand. What are we, like 0 for 8 now? I mean, seriously, this is like we keep putting these guys in power and then they don't work out because the communities that we're putting them in are not appropriate. You know, we obviously there are a lot more political concerns going on in Yemen than we first considered, or we wouldn't have had this eruption of violence occurring around the presidential palace. But anyway, again, just conjecture on my part. And Belarus right now. Belarus is one of these countries that we talked about a little bit in relation to Russia. They are a country that has been separated from Russia for quite a long time. But right now, their ruble has been hurting pretty bad. So they are looking again at isolating themselves from Russia in every way that they possibly can. And just this week, in fact, they officially published a new law on the subject of martial law in Belarus. So what they're essentially doing right now is they are revising documents, essentially after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. They're revising their in-house documents so that they can definitively declare martial law if anything like that happens on their property at the behest of Russia. So that's essentially what's going on. Belarus is sort of battening down the logistical hatches, so to speak. They're getting ready just in case, and they want to make sure everybody in the government is understanding their role in the incident, you know, if the incident occurs that they have to, declare martial law because they've been invaded by Russia or whatever. So anyway, a lot of people still preparing for bad things to happen all around the world. And I'm just kind of pointing that out because it does relate to our lives, not necessarily that Russia's going to come here, but somebody could come here and you just never know. So, you know, Belarus is preparing. You should too. That's all I'm saying. The French police. How's that gun control thing working out for you guys over in France? Oh, it's not working out well at all. Following the deaths of two French police officers, of course, during the January 7th Charlie Hebdo attack, and another officer death during an attack the following day, French police are now demanding more guns and guns that are more powerful. According to the Associated Press, French police unions met with their interior ministry officials on January 19th, seeking to take the advantage away from terrorists and other attackers. The unions demanded more guns, heavier guns, and protective gear, better training for first responders, and more legal tools to guard against terrorists. So again, they don't want you to have guns, but they definitely want to have more guns because, well, they're getting shot at by terrorists. So I guess that kind of makes sense. Kind of have to wonder where the guns that the terrorists got came from, don't you? Maybe that's just me. I don't know. All these questions just roll through my mind. Let's see. FBI had a pretty substantial story come out yesterday. They arrested three Russians charged with spying. They charged three Russians with spying. Two of them got away and they arrested one in New York. Now I'll clarify that a little bit. So federal prosecutors in the United States have announced charges against three Russian men who allegedly operated in an international spy ring based out of New York. U.S. attorney said Monday that these three guys, which have very, very Russian names, have been charged in connection with the Buryakov's service. So now this guy, Evgeny Buryagov. Man, we got to get these guys some vowels, I swear. We need like a major vowel delivery over to Russia to separate some of these words into tangible things that I can say. Anyway, this gentleman unlawfully acted as an unregistered agent of a foreign government, according to these federal complaint allegations, and his co-defendants were charged with conspiracy thereof. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation says that their investigation into the three co-defendants began shortly after 10 alleged Russian spies, including Anna Chapman, were arrested back in 2010 following a multi-year investigation. Within a few months of the Russians' subsequent guilty pleas, according to this week's statement, the FBI began investing these other three gentlemen whose names I cannot pronounce. According to the FBI, the first gentleman, his name starts with a B, maintained a cover job in the U.S. as an employee in the Manhattan office of a Russian bank, but actually worked to gather intelligence for Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, SVR. A public LinkedIn profile for a man with the same name as this Russian dude suggests that he may have been working as a deputy representative for the U.S. In Russia's Veshnagamina Bank. So big Russian bank. Okay. So the other two posed as Russian trade representatives and is a United Nations attaché, respectively, but allegedly worked as intermediaries between gentleman number one and the SVR, according to Department of Justice. Together, the three are accused of aiding the Russian Federation's intelligence gathering operations by collecting details on economic issues and other matters that could be exploited for the Kremlin's gain. So according to the sealed complaint, essentially what they are accusing these gentlemen of doing is fishing for details on potential sanctions against Russia. So it's unusual, again, that one of these guys happened to work for a Russian Manhattan bank. But that's what they were allegedly doing, fishing for details on potential sanctions against Russia. And as they could, they were distributing that information to the people who might be affected by it. So anyway, three Russians arrested. Well, one Russian arrested, the other two split the country. And apparently, according to the FBI, they are now protected by diplomatic immunity from arrest and prosecution. I bet that first dude really wishes he'd gotten a phone call or at least a tweet from the second and third dude saying, hey, good time to get on the plane right now. Remember the old diplomatic immunity issue. Let's all go take advantage of that. Anyway, an office worker tackled a machete-wielding jewelry thief in London over the weekend. Very cool. So the video now has gone viral, but the footage basically shows a passerby run up behind this suspected thief. The thief was working with a couple of other guys, and they broke into car watches and diamonds in the city of London at about 2:30, and they used a big brick, break through the windows, and two of the guys were running away, and this guy was attempting to run away, but a passerby ran up, jumped on this guy in an attempt to get him to the ground, but then the guy whipped out a machete, and so office worker dude said, you know, nah, maybe this isn't exactly what I want to be doing with my afternoon. So he left running, and then the police eventually caught up to the guy with the machete and made an arrest on him. The other two guys are still escaped and remain on the run. So if you live in London, have any information about people that you know that have come home with a lot of jewels recently, London police might want to know about it. Just saying. And probably not a good idea to just tackle people with machetes. Just, you know, maybe, I don't know. Boy, if they only had concealed weapons in London, stuff like this just probably wouldn't happen. Anyway, 3-minute break, guys. We've got a lot more news to get to. Appreciate you guys being here. Appreciate you guys in the chat room. We're going to go take this 3-minute break, and we'll be right back. Keep it right here, guys.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
Big business has discovered the preparedness market, and that makes it difficult to know where to go and who to trust. MyPatriotSupply.com is owned and operated by patriots just like you, has the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more. MyPatriotSupply.com has old-fashioned values and the absolute best customer service in the industry. Look for the deal of the day, unique affordable survival supplies that fit anyone's budget. Get same-day shipping on all orders and free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927, 866-229-0927, or visit MyPatriotSupply.com for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence. Shop with a name you know and a name you can trust. Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
Chris and Cherie Geo, Saturdays and Sundays on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the radio show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. It is the bottom of the first hour right now, and this is the news segment, and we've got plenty of news to talk about. But it looks like I have a phone call right now on the board, so I'm just going to go ahead and assume that they want to talk to me, and we're going to bring them into the show. So hopefully they're ready and listening right now. So here we go. Let's see what's going on here. Hello, caller from Ohio. You are on the air with the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. Who are you, and what's on your mind?
Hey, JD. My name's Lee, and
hey,
I'm just calling in to tell you how much we appreciate you.
Aw, that's so nice to hear. Thanks, man.
And we love the show. You give great commentary. I love the guests that you have on. And I got to say, that website is amazing.
Oh, I mean, isn't it just?
I go to that. I go to that to get all my news. I don't even go anywhere else at this point in time. It's like the Drudge Junior, if you will.
Oh, that's like the best news ever. I'm sure that our web guru Robert will really, really appreciate hearing that. He does such a great job working on that website, and I'll tell you, man, the more people that go there, the more comments like that we get. He's just done such a fantastic job. And I'll tell you, the other gentleman, Jeff, the other co-creator, man, these guys just work so hard behind the scenes. I couldn't possibly do this without them, and it wouldn't be any fun to do it. So I've got to tell you, man, the credit goes back to those guys in a huge way.
Well, it shows because you guys do a fantastic job, man.
Oh, we appreciate it. Hey, can I just ask a question? How are you listening out there, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, right now I'm on my landline phone.
Oh, right. So you do the
calling number.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. I'm glad that's an option. That's Chris works so hard, you know, at True Frequency to make the show available in a lot of different formats. So I always like to find out how it is that people are listening. I think a lot of people appreciate that. So anything else you want to talk about? News or anything going on in your mind?
No, that was it, man.
Okay.
Keep up the good work, brother.
Will do. Will do. I appreciate you calling in, and you take care. And anything else comes up, you just give us another holler back or join us in the chat room, okay?
Okay. Thanks, right. JD, for taking my call.
Dude. Oh, man. Thanks for calling in, Lee. You guys, you take care out there, buddy.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Oh, man, ladies and gentlemen, that is so cool. I love getting phone calls. This is just awesome. And I love you guys in the chat room as well. Appreciate the feedback. It just makes this job so much more fun when I get to talk to people. So, Lee, thank you very much for calling in, man. That was awesome. Okay, let's see here. Jumping back into the national news right now, and I'll keep an eye again on the phone line, so just in case anybody else wants to call in. And, of course, if you are in the chat room, I'll do my best to relay questions and comments from that as well. Okay, so a new report has come out, and it has found no clear warning signs before the deadly shooting that happened at Fort Hood. So we're talking about the instance with Specialist Ivan Lopez. Remember, he opened fire on the Army base back in April 2nd of last year, killed 3 soldiers, and he injured another 12, and then ended up taking his own life. Well, the U.S. Army has now officially closed its investigation into the April 2014 shooting at Fort Hood that left those 4 people dead. The Army has now concluded that there was nothing in the assailant's background, medical, or military profile that might have provided officials with a warning sign that he would act violently. So not necessarily sure that that's entirely accurate. The investigators did note that there were various stressors that may have contributed to his state of mind, Lopez's state of mind, and 2 of the shooter's close family members had recently died. He was obviously experiencing a lot of difficulties in terms of that, but it also comes out that he was experiencing some financial difficulties as well and may have even been struggling with some personal health issues. He had arrived at Fort Hood very shortly before the attack after being transferred in from another assignment. The report does note that a variety of leadership and management shakeups at the base may have left officers with an inefficient time to train, mentor, and lead new soldiers. But despite that, investigators concluded that even had there not been shortcomings in leadership at the time, there would not have been any reason to assume that Lopez would have, exhibited the violent outburst like he did. So I guess, you know, that case is officially closed in terms of the U.S. Army. But I think that one of the things that they're not talking about on this, again, the guy was depressed. He was being treated for PTSD, and he was most likely on some sort of psychotropic drug. And that's one of the things that just doesn't come up in any of these stories. And it drives me crazy because, there's so many stories out there about these guys that get put on these drugs. You know, Wellbutrin and all this junk, and it really messes with their brain. You know, a lot of these guys, I've heard stories of vets coming back on as many as 14 different prescriptions. No way that the FDA, you know, can say definitively that one prescription is not dangerous, and let alone the fact that you can compile, you know, 14 together at a time and then wonder why the guy can't urinate and can't sleep and is seeing, you know, pictures in the mirror talking to him, and it's just tragic what we're doing to these veterans right now. And again, they're closing this investigation, and no mention of psychotropic drugs, and that just drives me crazy, because I guarantee if you were to dig into that, you would be able to find something there. But anyway, moving on here, an ex-Fox producer shot himself apparently to death outside of the New York City headquarters yesterday. A former employee at Fox television station in Texas shot himself to death outside of the company's New York headquarters on Monday, shortly after handing out flyers saying the company had ended his career. This gentleman's name was Philip Perea. He was 41. He apparently shot himself in the chest around 9 o'clock in the morning, Monday, outside of the building near Radio City Music Hall that houses Fox News, the New York Post, and the Wall Street Journal. Perea has left a suicide note, according to authorities, and a weapon was recovered at the scene, and no other injuries were reported. He was pronounced dead shortly after arriving at the hospital on Monday. He was an employee as a producer at Fox News in Austin until June, according to Fox officials, and he worked at the station Fox 7 KTBC for about 10 months after that, according to a statement from Jack Abernathy, who is CEO of Fox Television. Essentially, this gentleman says that he got fired by Fox for dubious reasons. He's posted a number of YouTube videos in a series that was called The American Workplace Bully, and it chronicles what he said was management's cover-up of very bad decisions being made at Fox. In his last video, he actually said that 2014 was the worst year of his life, and he said that it was time now for Fox News to have the worst year of its existence. But tragically, it just bothers the heck out of me, ladies and gentlemen, when somebody does something like this, because life is never really this bad. If you need help, there are people out there who can help you. I mean, the gentleman obviously was going through a lot, and he blamed Fox News for quite a bit of it. I mean, he even had a tweet that came out that says, "Congratulations, Fox. This is all the money I have left to my name. It's $104. You know, and I get that. I get being frustrated with a former employee. Believe me, I have been there. I've worked for months and not been paid for work before, and it drives you crazy. But at the end of the day, you're not the problem. You know, you taking yourself out of the mix, it doesn't help anybody else fix the problem. It doesn't uncover the corruption that's going on at Fox. It just gives them an opportunity to say, oh, he was disturbed and it was sad and now he's gone, so we never have to think about it again. So again, he didn't, you know, this Perea guy didn't do anything for anybody. It just drives me crazy. So if you're out there and you need help, please send me an email. My God, I'll talk to you. Somebody should talk to these people. I can't imagine, that's an acceptable, you know, thing going on today. I don't like it. Oh, we got another caller, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to assume that they want to talk to me. So let's just take this call here. Hold on just 1 second. Hello, caller from Pueblo, Colorado. You are on the air with Red Pill Reports radio broadcast. What's on your mind and what's your name?
My name is Obi, and I'm calling to kind of chat a little bit about the reason the stock market's down, and I've got another issue I want to talk about briefly.
Oh, perfect.
The stock market's down today because of Greece and that election that happened there. Is that they want out of the Ponzi scheme, and so that's making the people on Wall Street nervous that everybody else is going to want to bail out on the Ponzi scheme. And so I think that's why the stock market's down.
See, I see
Secondly, I was an oil...
Obi, let me just interrupt for a second. I totally get that point, but for me, it seems like if the euro is going down in value, and a lot of people are concerned that it is, it has. I mean, over the last week, we've seen the euro go down. I would have thought that the dollar, A, and the American stock market would have been kind of a safe haven for some of these guys, you know, the same way that the gold market would have been. So it surprises me to see the euro trend going the way it's going and the U.S. stock market not acting as a safe haven. Maybe that's just me.
Well, all of the markets are tied together. They're really not separate. You know, the euro is just the dollar. I mean, they're all tied together. The same interest are the shareholders of the IMF, the World Bank, the Federal Reserve.
Right.
It's the same people that own all of that. So everything's tied together. And if people are trying to bail out of the Ponzi scheme, they get nervous.
I hear you.
Because you got to have more. You got to have more people coming in to keep the Ponzi scheme afloat. One more point I want to make. I was an oil field worker for 15 years, from 84 until 99. And when we were doing work out at the wellhead, I found out that companies who produced toxic waste were bringing their waste out to old oil wells that had been pumped out and were dry. And the oil companies were getting paid by these people to, you know, pump this waste down into the ground so they could skirt the EPA.
Wow. So they can just hide it. Wow.
And I witnessed this happening over 15 years dozens of times. You know, and I even talked to some of the people who were, you know, in charge. And I won't mention the company that was doing it because I don't want a lawsuit. But I talked to some of the people in charge, and they were like, we get paid good money to do this, and you need to mind your own business. And so, but I, you know, they were using the old oil wells as a toxic dump.
Right.
Well, when you do oil well work, those formations under there leak. You know, that whatever you put in there leaks out. It doesn't stay there. And so they were, you know, and this is still going on today. They're even doing it with some of the fracking. You know, you can't find out what chemicals they're using in it now because they don't want people to know that chemical companies are paying the oil companies to dump the waste.
Right. Right.
And they pump it underground and leave it there.
Wow. Obi, do you think you could send us a contact through contact@redpillreports.com? Because that's a story that we have not heard about, especially with you talking about it going back. I mean, we're talking, that's 20 years that they've been doing this. That's insane. And that's, I've never even heard of that before. But again, it's not surprising. I'm disgusted and I'm shocked a lot these days, but I'm not surprised by anything. And if there's a market there for someone to make money, they're gonna absolutely take advantage of that. Don't you think, Obi?
Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, it's all about the dollar bills in the oil industry. How many of them can they make?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd be happy if you could put me on hold or whatever, and I can give you my email address and or phone number, and we can go from there.
Okay, or if you just want to send me an email at jd@redpillreports.com, you can put anything you want in there, and then I can reach out to you after the show, and we can take it from there, buddy.
JD@redpillreports.com. Okay,
yes,
let me write that down before I forget it.
All right.
But I'll get in touch with you.
Perfect. Man, Obi, I can't thank you enough for calling in today. That's a fantastic story and something that we haven't had on the radar yet, so I really appreciate the phone call.
You're very welcome, and I'm new to the show, but I enjoy it and keep up.
Oh, well, I'm new to the show, too, and I appreciate the fact that you enjoy it. Can I just ask how it is that you listen out there?
Over the Internet.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. All right, man. Well, Obi, you take care. Have a great, wonderful rest of your day. And I will shoot you an email after the show after I get yours. And I want to flesh this story out a little bit. Thank you very much again for giving us a call today, Obi.
You're very welcome.
All right. Take care, buddy. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's two phone calls for the first time ever at redpillreports.com. I cannot tell you guys how thankful I am that people are calling in. That was a wonderful call. Obi, you are a rock star, buddy, for calling in with that story, and definitely want to get in touch and see if we can flesh some of those details out, because that's crazy. That's crazy going back to the 90s that they were using empty wells to store waste to skirt the EPA. I mean, again, I am disgusted by that, but am I surprised by that? No, of course not. That seems to be par for the course for all of these people that are out there doing dirty deeds, man. That's just how the money flows. But wow, out of sight, out of mind. That's just absolutely unbelievable to me. So again, Obi, thank you very much for that phone call. Let's get back into some national news. And again, we'll keep an eye on the phone lines in case anybody else would like to call in. That phone number is 866-37-TRUTH or 866-378-7884. Keep an eye on all of that. Two Seattle planes were diverted yesterday, evacuated on arrival Sunday, at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport due to what spokesmen were calling a security concern. So this comes from airport spokesman Perry Cooper, and he said that a JetBlue flight from Long Beach, California, and a regional SkyWest jet from Phoenix were the aircrafts involved. Cooper also said that out of an abundance of caution, passengers were bused to their gates from the airport's third runway. And he said the whole matter was investigation. Nobody's got any kind of details coming out right now. And additionally, a Delta Airlines spokesman said a flight from L.A. to Orlando was diverted to Dallas on Sunday afternoon due to another security concern. And the spokesman there said the passengers on flight 1061 got off the Boeing 373 so that authorities could search the aircraft in Dallas. Now, I don't know if you guys are paying attention, but these flight disruptions come just a day after bomb threats targeted two jets bound for Atlanta. Remember, they had two different scrambles of F-16s fighter jets to escort these jets or to escort these planes into the runways. So that's like five credible, tangible threats over the last 3 days involving airliners here in the United States. Again, no explosives have been found. Nobody has been hurt by any of these things. Everybody has been free and clear. But it does seem like at least the Twitter campaign in terms of threats is really ramping up right now. I mean, five different airlines over just since just Sunday. Today's Tuesday, the last time I checked. That's not very long in terms of time. So, man, I'll tell you what, if I was flying right now, I'd be more than a little bit concerned. A little flashback story here I wanted to give just as a reminder, anybody thinking about voting for Hillary, that last year, I know, I think it was 2013, The Hill actually did a little report on Clinton going over and visiting with the newly dead Saudi Arabian king. It's all important to remember, too, that Saudi Arabian king, very, very good friends with both the Bushes and the Clintons. Also, that Saudi Arabian king had a proclivity for killing people accused of sorcery. Just saying, you know, if accused of sorcery. That's like killing somebody for believing in Santa Claus. Just saying. But anyway, while Hillary was there back in 2013 talking to the now dead King Abdullah, probably in the middle of his sorcery executions, happened to give her some jewelry, you know, white gold jewelry, teardrop rubies, diamonds containing a necklace, bracelet, earrings, and a ring, all bestowed upon Miss Clinton by King Abdullah, valued at about $500,000. So I wonder where all my good friends are. I don't have good friends that give me $500,000 worth of jewels. I must be doing something really wrong with my life, because the Clintons, man, they just must be flying super high. But can you imagine just going over to visit some friends and they just give you $500,000 worth of jewels, just some little baubles, no big deal. The White House did report an incident yesterday, too. Very, very serious stuff here. A drone landed on the grounds of the White House early Monday morning at about 3 o'clock. Officials say the device posed no threat. The drone landed in a tree at about 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday inside the grounds of the White House compound there. And of course, police, fire, other emergency vehicles swarmed the White House in the pre-dawn hours. With several clustered near the southeast entrance to the mansion. The house was dark at the time, and the entire perimeter was on lockdown until about 5 a.m. when people started showing up that were allowed to come inside. But here's the deal. It's saying, you know, they found a drone. It was a two-footer, you know, a quadcopter kind of deal, and it did get into the property. So first of all, who is out there flying drones at 3 o'clock in the morning around the White House? That's a little suspicious in and of itself. And B, the fact that they're saying there's no threat to this incident. Well, you know, I'm not a genius, and I'm certainly not a mad scientist, but I would imagine I could get a quadcopter loaded up with some kind of aerosol distributing, thing, that could poison people or maybe shoot a dart or whatever. It seems unusual to me that the airspace above the White House, especially, you know, that close to the ground, was obviously, it was breached because this thing landed in a tree. And, no big deal. Not a threat. No big deal. No, nothing to see here. But anyway, that's what happened yesterday at the White House. White House and, the Senate, House and the Senate right now are also, considering a new bill. And I really have to support this because they're considering a bill to allow hemp production nationwide. And again, whether or not you believe in the legalization of marijuana or whatever, it doesn't really have anything to do with this issue. I think if we look across the pond at China or look to our Canuckian northern neighbors up there, we'll probably discover that the hemp industry is a couple of billion dollars a year industry. And the fact that we have shot ourselves in the foot by not allowing this into our country is absolutely tragic. And so I'm really excited when these people in Washington are starting to think pretty clearly about what it is that we need to do in our country to start growing, economically. And so, Republican Congressman Thomas Massie, he is from Kentucky. Obviously, Kentucky has been at the forefront of the hemp legalization movement. They have tried for the last couple of years to get some pilot programs going there. But he essentially now is trying to get an industrial hemp farming act to go through the House and Congress. And I think that this one might actually pass. So if you guys are in his district, Representative Massie, this should be something that you guys support. I really, really like, too, his hashtag that he came up with for this particular thing. A hashtag is obviously how people communicate on Twitter. But the hashtag that relates to articles in this bill is "Think Rope, Not Dope." And I like that. I think that's really clever. And again, I cannot really think of anything that would boost our economy here in this country more than legalizing hemp. I think it's a super big deal. Again, the ancillary businesses that correlate with that are just huge, from oil production to textile production. It's ridiculous how absolutely amazing that plant is, and the fact that we don't grow it here is one of the reasons we're not growing economically the way we could be. So let's see here. Okay. There was an earthquake also in Grant County, Oklahoma yesterday. This one topped out at 4.3. This is the largest earthquake they've had in a little while, but they have been getting a lot of earthquakes recently there. So I just wanted to point that out. Always a good time to have an earthquake preparedness plan, ladies and gentlemen. Let's move on quickly. How much time do we have left here? Oh, we're running out of time. 345 points right now. Down. That's what the Dow is. 345 down. And Obi called in, said it's because of the Greece thing. He might be very well right. He might be very well right that all the economies are connected, and that when one goes down, another goes down. Again, it's difficult for me to say, because when I learned about economy stuff, economics is what they call it in school, there was this whole chapter about fundamentals, and one of them was supply and demand. And I'll tell you what, like a fish, I bought that hook, full baited hook, line and sinker. And, I don't think that there's any fundamentals that really apply anymore. So for me, it's really difficult to see, what is going on in the economy with any kind of real, actual, this is what's going on. So again, a lot of conjecture, but oil definitely down a little bit today, 45.50. It was up about 46 when I checked in this morning. So, 45.50. Oil still pretty staying steady there at that, $45 mark there. And, gold again, we see in some safe haven buying after the dip. I thought that we would see a dip. We did see one yesterday. It was down at about 1280. Of course, the Bank of America coming out instructing all of their buyers to buy the dip. They knew that that was going to happen, but that there would be some selling off happening at that $1,300 mark. Again, that's a pretty big psychological barrier for oil. So I assume that's what happened, and now we're at the buying the dip phase. So we're at 1293, and it's up about a 1% today. So imagine if you've got the money, playing this little $10 and $20 window with gold for a while, probably pretty advantageous for all of you guys. Coinbase came out with a pretty big announcement. They have officially opened an exchange. Now, it isn't actually running right now, but there is going to be a U.S.-based Bitcoin exchange, and Coinbase is going to be the lead of that. So we saw a little bit of a rise in the value of Bitcoin. It's up about $22 over the last 24 hours, settling in right now at about $261.28, and I do imagine that The idea of a large exchange opening up, probably playing into that a little bit. IBM had a crazy goofy day yesterday. I'll tell you what, there was a rumor that came out over the weekend that IBM was going to undertake the largest, what do you want to call it? The largest shakeup reorganization in corporate history. They came out over the weekend, and some of the people who are familiar with the situation there suggested that IBM or Big Blue would slash its global workforce by 26%. That 26% represented a little over 100,000 people. We're talking about 112,000 people. So what happened when that announcement came out? Well, the stock market went crazy. Everybody started investing in IBM. IBM was up like 3% on Monday, 3.8% actually. And then IBM came out and they said, oh, hey, about that whole report thing. We're not going to comment on that, but it is just a rumor, and probably the numbers of layoffs will be not anywhere near that initial 110,000 estimation. And then so what happened as soon as they made that announcement? Well, the stock started crashing again. So it's funny, if you go look at the chart between the time that they made the announcement initially and then when the report came out over the weekend, I should say, and then when they made the announcement yesterday morning that they were not going to be laying off all of those people, that the stock market started crashing again. Man, people are fickle. Stockholders are some fickle people, I'll tell you what. But potentially now, we're still not really sure, but it does look like IBM may in fact be laying off 120 or 112,000 people. Again, they're not commenting on rumors, and we won't really know until later this week when the shakeup actually happens. But it did send the stock market into a tizzy yesterday, just to say officially, I get to say the word tizzy on the air. I like doing that. Standard & Poor on Monday downgraded Russia's sovereign credit rating to below investment grade as the country's economy continues to weaken. So S&P slashed Russia's sovereign credit rating to BB plus from BBB minus and said the outlook is negative-ish, reflecting its view that Russia's monetary policy flexibility could further diminish. This is the first time in more than 10 years that the Russian sovereign debt has been rated below investment grade in what some call junk territory. It could not only harm Russia's image amongst investors, but it could also push up its borrowing costs, as many mainstream investment and pension funds have been implementing rules preventing them from buying anything not classed as investment grade. And the rating agency says that Russia's financial system is weakening and therefore limiting the central bank of Russia's ability to transmit monetary policy. So again, Russia and China last week announcing that they were creating their own new rating system, and so everybody else can just pretty much take a flying leap. Wow, we are out of the first hour, ladies and gentlemen. I didn't get through all the news that I wanted to. Please go to redpillreports.com and get into the show section. You'll be able to learn a little bit more about Simon Black, who will be joining us here in about 5 minutes. Keep it right here, guys. 3 minute break. Awesome, awesome guest on deck, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Keep it here.
Chris and Sheree Geo here, founders of Truth Frequency Radio. We just wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for making TFR the biggest and the best independent radio station out there.
When we first entered the alternative media scene in 2009, we were really taken aback by the amount of infighting, backbiting, fear-based reporting, and ego-driven personalities. That's when we knew we had to set ourselves apart and set a new standard in broadcasting. And thus, TFR was conceived as a listener-supported station with no corporate or outside influence and limited commercial interruptions.
You can support our efforts by signing up for a VIP membership at truthfrequencyradio.com/signup or by making a donation at truthfrequencyradio.com/donate.
For less than $4 a month, you can ensure that TFR continues broadcasting for years to come. Real people, real radio.
Wherever you are, make it TFR.
We are submersed in a construct that was designed to break us and keep us broken. But it hasn't. It failed. We still go on because we were designed from an eternal template of infinite creativity and not a synthetic house of cards built on pride and false power. Breaking free from the programs and paradigms that hold us down takes courage, endurance, tenacity, and trust. The reason it is so hard is because to be a free and sovereign being, we have to smash every lie, even if it hurts. It is good to be reminded of how resilient, unbreakable, magnificent, and powerful we truly are. And if anything provides a foundation for that, it is the book, Our Universal Journey. Go to ouruniversaljourney.com.au.
Judith Baker was once a promising science student who dreamed of finding a cure for cancer. This exposé is an account of how she strayed from a path of mainstream scholarship to a life of espionage in New Orleans with Lee Harvey Oswald. In her narrative, she offers extensive documentation on how she came to be a cancer expert and what led to her involvement in the development of a biological weapon that Oswald was to smuggle into Cuba to eliminate Fidel Castro. Details on what she knew of Kennedy's impending assassination and her belief that Oswald was a deep cover intelligence agent who was framed for an assassination he was actually trying to prevent are also revealed. Me and Lee by Judith Baker. Special JFK 50th Anniversary Signed Limited Edition. $30 including shipping. Limited number of these available. Order your copy today at federaljack.com/store.
No hate. No hype. No fear. We are TFR. Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the radio show. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. I'm very hopeful that we have Simon Black on the phone. So just let me go to the board here and we will bring this caller in and see if this is Mr. Simon Black. Bear with me here just 1 second, guys. Hello, caller from Texas. Is this Mr. Simon Black on the phone, I hope?
It sure is.
Oh, man, that is fantastic. Simon, thank you very much for joining us on the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast today.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you here. As I said, you probably haven't been listening to the show, but I'm a big follower of your website, Sovereign Man, or sovereignman.com, I should say. And I also get your newsletters as well. But for people who might not know who you are, would you do us a favor and just kind of elucidate us on your background and how you got started in the entire, I don't want to call it the sovereign movement, because that's kind of one of those, flash red flag type words.
Yeah, that's like that's a bad word now.
Yeah,
I can't say that. I hate talking about myself a whole lot. I really like talking about the, you know, the facts that are out there, but just to give folks a little bit of background, I used to be an Army intelligence officer. I attended West Point and was commissioned as a lieutenant in the Army, and sort of started undergoing a bit of a transition during my time in the service. I was in a unit, was where one of the sort of very early units into Kuwait, actually before the Gulf War actually kicked off. And I remember, you know, sitting there watching George W. Bush try and make the case for war. And as an intelligence officer, and the information that I had available seemed pretty obvious to me that it was a total lie. And I remember some very dark days there, you know, it sort of shattered my entire perception of the U.S. and government in general and so forth. And I remember thinking, well, if they're lying about that, you know, something that was so solemn and sacred as sort of the case for sending people into harm's way and declaring war and so forth, then what else are they lying about? And that led me down this, you know, this journey where I uncovered all these truths about the dollar and debt and so forth, and really the nature of freedom itself. And that's led me down a path where I've been traveling around the world. I've been to 116 countries now on all 7 continents. I actually just visited Antarctica for the first time a couple of weeks ago, so ticked the box on that one. But now I do business all over the world. I travel extensively, and what Sovereign Man's really all about is to try and sort of spread a message and let people understand out there the rational facts of what's happening. There's a lot of I think there's a lot of hype and sort of over sensationalized version lastly, you know, we try to be very data-driven, you know, using kind of publicly available, and people understand essentially here's what's happening, and that there are consequences when governments print trillions of dollars and conjure that out of thin air, and there are consequences when governments are $18 trillion in debt and have no sign of slowing consequence to that. But the nice thing is that while you can't really fix your government, you can fix yourself, and you can ensure that you're risk associated with that, and that's really the message that we try and get across.
And so you do a newsletter as well. How often does that come out?
We have a number of different products and services. So our Notes from the Field comes out every single day. It's a free service for people. And it's really more people understand what's going on and what their options are. That we have more action and intelligence services that actually help people direct specific actionable intelligence about you know, the who, what, where, when, and how to take steps. Just to give an example, we might one of the things that we very few people really question the financial health of their bank, right? We just walk into a bank and we bank, and so therefore it must be safe. It's backed by the government. It's got some sort of brick and mortar, FDIC guarantee.
Yeah, they've got a big.
Oh, it's okay.
They got a big metal vault in the back. Of course, they're solid. Where are they going to go?
Of course, it must be strong. And obviously, it's not actually the case. And the interesting thing is that banks actually tell us that they're not so safe. Their own financial data, their own balance sheets. And again, this is all publicly available data. This is not any tinfoil hat. Any person with a, with a modicum of financial education can cheat and say, wait a minute, hold on. You're telling me that, out of, $1 billion in, you only keep $10 million in cash equivalents, 1%. Money, the rest of my money is loan, is, put in some, who knows what, making loans to lenders or, highly toxic, derivatives and different securities and so forth. I mean, they're taking wild bets with our money, and they put it all right down there in black and white and paper and really go and look at that and see. And so, we would make a put your money in another place, in another bank that's safer, that's stronger, that's more liquid, that's more stable. There are plenty of places out there in the world where you can do that and present that, those facts and the actionable information to people.
Well, I love it. I mean, to me, that's such a huge deal. I'm diversified. I've got an account with euros in it, and I'm watching the euro account just drain itself right now after this whole Swiss deal. But I guess I really like the idea about finding a bank someplace that's actually not in a mess like the ones that we have in the States. How hard is it to open a bank account in another country? I mean, do you have to physically travel there? I mean, what kind of stuff are you have to consider before you become internationally diversified?
Well, it depends on the jurisdiction. There are, some places become more difficult, some places become less difficult. In general, there's kind of been a global against basically everybody that's outside of the United States. It's been really crazy, actually, the way the U.S. has passed some of the most arrogant Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act that they passed now in effect, basically requires every bank in the world to sign an information sharing agreement with the IRS. Now, you tell me, if you're a bank, who in their right mind wants to sign an agreement that puts you squarely in bed with the Internal Revenue Service? The U.S. government is sort of forcing this to happen, and there's sort of a secret weapon they have to enforce this. They're exercising the nuclear option of cutting people off from the U.S. banking system.
Right, right.
Sort of de facto begging the rest of the world, please stop using the U.S. banking system and find an alternative. And that's exactly what's happening. They're sort of practically pushing the rest of the world, into the that are happy to sort of welcome them with open arms. So in some places, it has gotten a lot more difficult. Some places sort of anticipated this and it's become possible to open up an account in a lot of places around the world without actually having to get on a plane and travel and go anywhere. I mean, we've told our subscribers of places even in Singapore, which is one of, you know, a very strong place to bank. They've never had a banking failure in the history of their nation. And you can open up a bank by, you know, getting some documents sent off at the local post office. And so these are, there are a lot of really good opportunities out there, again, to be able to do these sorts of things without having to leave town.
Right.
And as we like to remind people, it really makes a lot of sense. You know, how are you worse off because you have some money in a bank in Singapore, that's 10 times more liquid than where you normally bank in the U.S. You know, there's not really a lot of downside there. You know?
Well, not especially if you can get
the worst happens.
Yeah, especially if you can use an ATM and do all the normal banking transactions that you would normally do. I don't know why, you know, I don't know anybody who would, you know, think twice about doing something like that, especially once you consider just how bad the banking industry in our country is in terms of its, you know, the outstanding derivative market. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. I'm waiting every day for the Bank of America to completely close its doors, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of risk out there. And one of the things that we've sort of seen over the last couple of years is that this isn't a sensationalist statement. It's just a statement of fact that, you know, governments essentially have no in, you know, what they're willing to do and really what they can do. They'll take the, you know, they'll far exceed the legal limitations of their own authority and do whatever it takes that they think they need to do to keep the party going a little bit longer. And so they've been able to really very cleverly delay and continue to delay and continue to delay a lot of the consequences. And it's like a bubble. It's something that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so, you know, when it pops, the bigger it is, the more catastrophic the consequences. And so whether it happens today, tomorrow, or 5 years from now, that doesn't really matter. Nobody really has a crystal ball and can say what's going to happen. Well, we just try and remind people have a plan B. And so, you know, a smart plan B is to take savings. And when all the objective evidence says, hey, you know what, these banks are really not safe, maybe I'll take a portion of my savings and move it overseas to a bank that actually is safe, a bank that is objectively stronger, safer, more sound. And oh, by the way, the added benefit that is some government agencies, you know, list that, you know, if you bank, you know, if you live in the U.S. and you work in the U.S., and you bank in the U.S. and decides that they don't like you, they can freeze your account,
yes,
you know, with a mouse click.
Yep.
And the most effort they'd have to make is a phone call. And yet, you know, they don't have the authority overseas. And there are many jurisdictions out there where, you know, we don't honor not only foreign executive agencies, but even foreign legal judgments. And you know, the benefits in terms of asset protection are really strong. A lot of people think, hey, I'm going to sue me. Yeah, famous last words. I'm never going to end up on the wrong list. Famous last words. I mean, if you think it can't happen, I mean, prisons are really full of people doing hard time for victimless crimes who never thought that, you know, any of these sorts of things would ever happen to them. And certainly, and maybe even on a proportional basis, relatively rare. But if you can do something without, you know, barely lifting a finger to ship a portion of your assets abroad in a place that can't be confiscated, in a place that's safer, more liquid, better capitalized, why wouldn't you do it? I mean, it's really a no-brainer.
Yeah, it does seem like a no-brainer to me too. I fully am planning on doing more of that than going forward. I'm wondering a little bit too about some of the other value that you hold personally. Like, are you a proponent of the precious metals? Are you a proponent of holding foreign currencies in fiat term, stuff like that?
Yeah, precious metals, you know, really an interesting thing. I view precious metals really as a form of money. If you ask me right now what the gold price is, I will tell you, because I don't follow it. I don't view gold and its value, you know, benchmarked against paper currency. The reason that I own gold is as a hedge against paper currency. And I own physical gold. I think it's pointless to own gold, you know, ETFs and things like that. I think, you know, if you do that, it really defeats the purpose. Gold is, you know, gold is a form of money. It is a hedge against paper currency. You own gold as a conscious decision to not own, but to sort of convert paper currency into something real. So to me, to sort of speculate in the gold price, you know, it defeats the purpose to trade paper currency for gold, hoping to trade gold back. Sort of defeats the point. The whole point is to get rid of paper currency and put it into something else. Sort of my take on gold, and I think that for people that want to speculate in gold and buy gold because it's cheap and think it's going to, you know, go up in price, I think there's a lot better speculations out there. You know, gold isn't really something, I think it's just something to own as a hedge. Mm-hmm. I don't know necessarily that people need to, you know, put you know, the preponderance of their, you know, net worth into gold, but just like having some extra cash, you know, having gold as really, you know, some savings, some rainy day funds, I think makes a lot of sense. But again, it's sort of as an investment or a speculation. I think there are a lot of other things out there to, you know, to speculate in. If you want to speculate in metals, there are other metals even to speculate in, that are more interesting, or, you know, different, market worth. You'd ask me as well about different foreign currencies. You know, my view is that the currency is fundamentally flawed. You know, when you think about this idea where we have, or we take a handful of bankers and award totalitarian control of the money supply to conjure as much money out of thin air as they feel like on a moment's notice, you know, to play these little games where, you know, overnight they say, oh, we're going to put a floor on under the currency. Oh, no, we're going to take it away now. Oh, now we're going to have negative. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, who is, you know, is it, you know, Mario Draghi saying, oh, we're going to print, you know, 60 billion, you know, euros a month, and, you know, and take rates down, you know, further into negative territory. Draghi, who is this guy? What gives him any authority over your savings? You know, I didn't pick this guy. You didn't pick this guy. I mean, he's some unelected who has the power, who has total control, really over the money supply. And, you know, in any system, even the last vestiges of whatever you want to call this quasi-capitalistic system that we have, money, you know, the flow of money and cash and currency and so forth is the law. I mean, they essentially give one person, or a small committee of people total control of. It's a complete hoax. It's a joke. And so precious metals is a hedge against that because they can't, you know, Mario draw or gold out of thin air. He doesn't have any control over that. He can control paper currency. So my view is that all paper currencies are fundamentally flawed. And they're all sort of tied. They're all in bed with one another, whether they're competing against each other, or, you know, valuing, you know, it's all this, I think, the same flawed principle. There are certainly some currencies that are better off than others, or have better fundamentals. The long run, I think sort of the beginning of the end of this paper system. And it's true, is history periodically, you know, monetary systems tend to reset. And, you know, we're the initial stages of that happening right now.
So, okay, that's interesting because, you know, I keep going back to Christine Lagarde's little speech about numerology that she did. And there's a lot of rumor around just talking about a potential global currency reset. And I'm watching all of these currencies now starting to kind of eke their way towards parity. You know, you see the euro coming down against the dollar and all of these currencies starting to kind of become, you know, level on a playing field. And I have that question in my mind still. Are we seeing the beginning of a global currency reset? What do you think?
Yeah. It's more than just the relationship in exchange rates. I mean, you know, and economics tells us about the law of one price that, you know, over the law on the world should essentially cost the same. And we see that from time to time. You know, The Economist has its, you know, Big Mac Index and so forth, which kind of is an interesting indication of currencies that are overvalued or undervalued and so forth. You know, looking at the reset in terms of is values against one another. I think the entire idea is the nature of the system itself. The system itself, remember, it came out of it really came out of the Bretton Woods Agreement after World War II. The United States was the only dominant superpower that remained, that still had its money supply, a pool of savings, its manufacturing, so forth, that were all intact. And so the United States is the primary piece of the global financial system. The U.S. dollar was pegged against gold and everything else. You know, the pound and the yen and so forth, and the franc, everything was pegged against the dollar. You know, Nixon entirely did away with that in the 70s, and since then everything's sort of been free-floating against one another. Where we're at right now is a system where I think the entire world, even U.S. allies, are openly wondering, why is the U.S. dollar still the dominant reserve currency? It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So in the 40s, but it doesn't really make any more sense today. The U.S. objective metrics is no longer the number one economy in the world. That it, even the IMF reported that after, as of late October, the largest economy in the world. The U.S. it's rather interesting is that, you know, the U.S. dollar, is fundamentally, underpinned by U.S. largest, you know, most liquid bond market in the world. The only reason that's the case is because the U.S. is the, in fact, you know, Larry Summers openly opined, can the world's largest debtor go along being the world's largest superpower? None of these things really make any sense anymore. And so what we're really looking at is an, and where the U.S. dollar becomes, just sort of a sideshow in an otherwise larger global financial system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I gotta ask you a question though about currency, because we keep talking about the American currency being, you know, fiat. I shouldn't even say the American currency, because obviously the Fed is a private organization that's actually a foreign currency in our country, which is why we're all susceptible to taxation. But I gotta ask you, in your opinion, is it a fiat currency, or is it actually backed by our future taxes, labor, wages, earning, talent, things like that? Is there an actual link between the human body and our fiat currency? Because I'm of the opinion that there is, but I'd like to know what your opinion is.
Well, if you pull out a dollar bill and you look at it, it doesn't really even say a dollar bill. I mean, it's reserve note. A dollar was something that was defined by the Coinage and Mint Act way back in, I want to say it was 1792, and it was a certain amount of. That's what a dollar was defined by the founding fathers, essentially. And so, what we're using right now, many times I even have a problem calling it a dollar, because it's not a dollar; it's a Federal Reserve note. In accounting terms, a note is just another word for liability. And remember, the Federal Reserve is actually a bank. And like any bank, banks have assets and liabilities. The assets of the Federal Reserve, ironically, is U.S. Treasury debt, agency debt, mortgage-backed securities from these U.S. housing agencies and so forth. Most of these things aren't really worth the paper that they're printed on. On a mark-to-market basis, they're way underwater on the treasuries. But anyways, those are the assets that they have. The liabilities for the Fed are really the money supply, the Federal Reserve notes, all the pieces of paper, all the digits and bank accounts and so forth. Actually, liabilities of the Fed. The interesting thing about it is the Fed liability. There's a very interesting Fed paper floating out there, written by in an obscure department of the Federal Reserve, but where they're basically, yes, it's true that, you know, all these are liabilities of the Fed, and we're at the point now where the liabilities almost exceed the assets, i.e. the Fed itself is very close to insolvency.
Wow.
And on a mark-to-market basis, if you actually marked down the assets to what they're actually worth in the marketplace, the Fed is actually insolvent. Again, this isn't Simon Black being crazy sensationalist. This is publicly available data that anybody with some finance for themselves. I would encourage your listeners to just Google the H41 report of the Federal Reserve. You can see it for yourself. You can see the assets and the liabilities, and the difference between the two is razor thin. At last count, I looked at it; it was about 1.2%, which is, extraordinarily low. Bear in mind, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt in 2008, Lehman Brothers
it was had a similar value of about 3%.
Yeah,
Lehman Brothers went under at 3%. So, and everybody made a big deal about, oh, Lehman Brothers was so irresponsible because they, you know, they had this on their books. The Fed is, you know, the Fed is less than 1.3%. You know, the Fed is less than a third of what Lehman Brothers had when they went bankrupt. And so, I mean, this is of capitalization that the Fed is trying to pass off. And yet these guys at the Fed are saying, yeah, it's true, you know, we're practically insolvent. However, because, you know, we have these Federal Reserve notes, and while they're, yeah, liabilities of the Fed, it's not like anybody can, you know, can come to the Fed and actually collect. I mean, you can't show up to the Fed with a dollar and slam it down on the counter and say, I'm here to collect. You know,
right.
I mean,
well,
to collect what? There's nothing that they have. It's an irredeemable law in accounting terms. And so, the larger point is, you know, is it really backed by any? And the point is that in the Fed's own view, it's by anything, because in the Fed's own view, they don't have to give you anything of value for the dollar. This isn't my conjecture. This is the Fed's own statement. You know, they're required to give you because they view dollars as irredeemable liabilities. If you look at so let's kind of go with this point that the Fed is almost insolvent. And again, not their own data, their own numbers. The Fed itself is telling us that they're almost insolvent. And so if we look to history and say, what happens when a central bank becomes insolvent? Okay, what's a good case of that? We don't have to go very far back in our history. We can look at what happened in Iceland just a couple of years ago. You know, went bankrupt, and practically overnight, the liabilities of the Iceland central bank, so the central bank in Iceland was insolvent. So what happened? You know, immediately they went into free fall. You know, the currency just collapsed and had to step in essentially and bail out the central bank. Iceland was in a position to do that because at the time they had basically no debt. So what happened? The government borrowed a lot of money, and it gave that money to the central bank to bail out the bank. Mm-hmm. Central bank is solvent, but the government now is heavily in debt. And who's on the hook for the government debt?
All the voters.
The people of Iceland.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. If you make that comparison to the United States, if something happens to the hook to bail out the Fed, the United States government. But there's just one problem. In Iceland, they could bail out their central bank because at the time when the central bank went bust, the government of Iceland were essentially debt-free. The United States government is not debt-free. The United States government has absolutely no ability to do this.
Okay, Simon, we got to
look
quick
at it. There's a lot of.
We got a quick 3-minute break
today.
Okay, I'm going to ask. Okay, well, yeah, we got to go 3-minute break. Ladies and gentlemen, keep it right here. We'll be right back with Simon Black. Please go to sovereignman.com and check out his absolutely amazing website and sign up for his newsletter. We're going to be right back. 3-minute break, guys.
Joe Joseph here for Truth Frequency Radio. According to allgov.com, since 9/11, a total of 238 Americans have died from a terrorist attack. That's 24 a year, making your chance of dying 1 in 625,000. Conversely, you have a 1 in 1,000 chance of becoming a victim of police brutality. Yet we spend trillions of dollars on the war on terror while militarizing an abusive police force. At TruthFrequencyRadio.com, we have a team of the very best personalities in independent media. A team that's dedicated to bringing you reliable and rock-solid news and information so you can arm yourself with knowledge and join the fight against worldwide oppression and tyranny. Truth Frequency Radio. News without the hate, hype, and fear.
After work, I'm so tired that I want to be left alone to sleep.
Hey, listen to me.
Who are you?
I'm you years ago when you felt healthy and young and everything worked on your body. Do you remember that?
Yes. I wish I felt like that now.
You can feel like that again with a new microplant powder formulation called Iodine Now. It cleans the entire body from head to toe and feeds the body what it really needs. You'll be in a better mood and you'll find more drive in your romantic life. Really? I gotta try iodine now and feel good again. It also protects you from radiation, heavy metals, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine, including cancer and most major diseases. You'll be amazed. You can be your own doctor. I want to keep you out of the hospital and off pharmaceuticals. Wow. Why are you so nice to me? Because I'm you. You're out of shape, and I need a better-looking future.
Call 888-910-4367. That's 888-910-4367. Iodine Now. Only at MUSA.org.
We all know the importance of having storable foods. But what about when the food runs out? What then? For real food independence, you need a supply of non-hybrid seeds. Introducing the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. The Survival Seed Vault is sealed for freshness and includes 20 varieties of easy-to-grow non-hybrid seeds for only $37.95. For less than $40, you've got real food independence. And the Survival Seed Vault includes detailed planting and seed-saving instructions. Imagine the barter power you'll have when the food supply does collapse. Right now, save $9 instantly when you buy three or more Survival Seed Vaults from MyPatriotSupply.com. Same day shipping on all orders, plus free shipping on orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness products at MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com.
Nathan Frazier.
Sundays, Truth Frequency Radio.
With us through that 3-minute break, we're moving into the final half an hour with our very special guest today, Mr. Simon Black of SovereignMan.com. I highly, highly, highly recommend his website as a one-stop shopping source for all of your information about international investment and diversifying yourself and trying to understand exactly what your place is here in the world as we know it to be. And very thankful for Simon joining us on the program. Simon, before the break, we were just kind of starting to talk about the insolvency of the Fed, the insolvency of the government in Iceland, and kind of the difference between those two situations on why Iceland was successful in banking or jailing all the bankers that had screwed their country over, and why, in your opinion, we might not be successful with that or a venture similar to it here. So if you want to pick it up right there, that would be great.
Sure. I mean, Iceland jailed some bankers, sure, but that, to me, it putting some guys behind bars doesn't really make up for indebting an entire nation. And that's essentially what happened in Iceland. Is now you've got an entire, you know, you've got millions of people now that are stuck paying off, you know, these massive government debts that they're never going to get rid of.
Right.
So, and they were the lucky ones. The problem is in the United States, you know, where the central bank to go and to become insolvent. And again, the central bank itself is telling us that they're really on borderline insolvency, and their capitalization levels really get thinner and thinner by the week. Mm-hmm. If that were to happen in the United States, the U.S. government doesn't have the financial capability to bail out the Fed. In fact, the Fed is really bailing out the U.S. government. It's the Fed that's going and financing the government's deficits and so forth. So if the Fed were actually being solved and the Fed needed a bailout, the U.S. government would not be able to do so. They'd have to borrow the money from the Chinese. They'd have to borrow the money from the rest of the world, and that's an incredibly unlikely scenario. I think that the U.S. government would be able to be in the position of indebting it, bailing out the Fed as sort of a – you know, back to your question about, you know, is the dollar ultimately backed by, on people? I think the debt of the United States is backed by, is backed by taxation, is backed by the labor and the hard work of American residents. But I think the dollar is really just a hopeless cause.
Right. Well, and again, we've already kind of outlined the fact that the dollar represents a liability for the Fed. And if you really understand that fundamentally, think about what would happen if you removed all the liability. If you soaked up all of the dollars, you'd still have a massive debt in the form of interest, which is why this entire plan to me seems like a Ponzi scheme, right? I mean, because there's not enough money issued to cover the principal and the interest. So somebody has to fail in order for the whole thing to work.
No, I mean, it is a Ponzi scheme. I mean, everything about it, it's a classic Ponzi scheme, and they're borrowing money to pay interest on money they've already borrowed. They're paying off, you know, whatever debt gets redeemed, they actually pay off. The only way they're paying it off is by going and borrowing money from other people. Mm-hmm. Classic Ponzi scheme.
Yeah,
they should have made Bernie Madoff the Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, I think he's right.
Oh, I got to tell you, man. When remember the My IRA thing that that Obama had come up with the big whole community IRA thing? I had read a report initially when that first came out that John Corzine was going to be in charge of that program, and it literally took me about a half an hour to figure out if that was real or not, because I just thought, you know, with this administration, they might actually do something like that, you know, and I wouldn't put it past them. I want to jump over into the sovereign citizen issue for just a second. I don't know how exactly you relate to that specific moniker, but I have a question from the chat room regarding the sovereign citizen movement and how, you know, what your thoughts are about the government classifying people who understand their sovereignty as terrorists these days. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts, I guess, about the sovereign movement in general, if I can be that bold?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, it's rather unfortunate that a word like sovereign now has become, associated with, you know, terrorism and crime and criminality and so forth. You know, I think, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time in the United States, and I'm not in touch with any people who are really into the sovereign, citizen movement. I mean, I know a little bit about it from headlines, but I believe very little of what I read in mainstream media. So I don't really know, that much about it or what people are after. You hear things some person from the sovereign citizen movement, you know, killing a police officer, and so that's essentially all anybody knows about it, right? I mean, and so they sort of it's kind of interesting, you know, whenever there's an act like something that happened in Paris, like this terrorist attack in Paris, and you know, leaders are always very quick to tell us, you don't judge Islam by the actions of a few people. You know, Islam is a peaceful religion, and, you know, we can't judge the acts of a few people. Well, you know, why do we judge the entire sovereign citizen movement by the acts of, you know, one guy who, you know, and shoots up a, you know, law enforcement officer? I think that people who believe in freedom are probably fundamentally very peaceful.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I know I am. I think part of the reason that people are so fed up with the United States, with government, and is because they're so tired of war. They're so tired of violence. They're so tired of itself on threats and coercion and so forth. I certainly am. And you know, to me, you know, do battle in the streets and so forth is antithetical to those principles. And I think it's, plus I don't think it's a battle worth fighting. I don't think it's a battle that, I would just rather move overseas and, you know, that's what I've done. And I think, you know, the lifestyle, the benefits, the privileges, the advantages and so, you know, being an expatriate living overseas and suddenly just, you know, really from, you know, that kind of drama, from that violence and the threats and the intimidation. You know, it's really actually quite, it's quite stress-free. I'm talking to you right out the window of my, of the house at, farm in central Chile. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a gorgeous day out here. It's summertime. You know, there's chickens walking around outside. You know, we grow all of our own food and we have our own water and we generate our own electricity. you know, I mean, you know, who needs violence and threats and intimidation and coercion when, you know, I mean, I'm completely resilient and self-sufficient. Yeah, to me, it seems like a better approach, but again, I'm not willing to judge an entire, you know, movement or philosophy or so forth, a couple of people. It just doesn't really make any sense. And I find it rather hypocritical, though, quick to defend something like Islam and yet so quick to, even freedom and essentially treat an entire dictionary word now as if it's a terrorist.
Yes. I could not agree with you more when it comes to that. I mean, for me, it's, it comes down to the fact that they're so anti, sovereignty because there must be some truth to it. There must be some remedy in there that they don't want people to find out about. And I, you know, I'll lay it out on the table. I act like a sovereign. You know, I do everything I can, when it comes to, writing letters to bill collectors and things like that. If I've had to do that and I've helped friends, I'm not somebody that's going to go out and, you know, shoot a police officer. I do understand, the people are fed up at this point with the violence, not only overseas, with the wars that we're committing, but just with our local law enforcement. The idea that people are starting to wake up to the idea that, that this is really just extortion, and that under a republic, which is what, you know, our country was founded at, your minority rights are the most important thing. That's where your rights come from God, and that's where these people took an oath to uphold those rights. And when they instead decide to pull you over for a stop sign violation and they put the city or the state above you, even though it's a construct of the minds of man and it shouldn't have any more rights than I do, they're essentially putting themselves and the state at a position above us. And a lot of people that don't want to be extorted or oppressed, dealing with quotas and things like that, that are not about protecting and serving the public. They're just about generating revenue. I think there are a lot of people out there who are really fed up with that. And I think that's where, once you start studying this movement in terms of civics and in terms of what the country is supposed to be about, that you really start to get upset. And I'm in that boat, man. I'm in that boat with those people who are upset. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to go shoot a police officer, but I would have a different interaction with police officers than most people would, because I don't necessarily believe that they have any authority over me. And I'm willing to argue that in court and on the side of the road with their supervisor if I have to. All that being aside, it does seem these days that, like my friend Obsidian is saying in the chat room, if you stand up for your rights, you are now a terrorist. And then it makes you wonder, whose rights the government is trying to protect if they're not yours. You know what I mean?
I mean, they're trying to protect the status quo, which is, you know, their power, their control. That's really all it comes down to. It doesn't matter necessarily who's in itself, really. You know, it's a handful of people that are pulling the strings, and, you know, I mean, people, you know, at high level, you know, banking people who control the currency, you know, people at high levels. It's just about keeping people in power at the expense of everybody else. This old as human history, as humans have organized themselves into certain that collective changes from time to time. We've seen tribes and kingdoms and empires and, you know, this, thing that we call the nation state, you know, we're trying to organize ourselves. And, you know, it's this sort of, you know, Keynesian bubble, you know, kleptocratic, you know, corporatocracy,
yes.
You know, is what it is. It's hard what this system is. But I think like everything else, you know, history is full of insightful lessons. I had mentioned this earlier that from time to time, the financial, global financial system changes. This has been happening since the days of the Byzantine Empire. It was the global reserve currency and it was abandoned by Europe in favor of the Florentine florin, and the, you know, which became the Spanish pieces of eight and the Dutch guilder and the British pound, and the system will change from time to time. So does the dominant superpower in the world. The Spanish Empire and the, you know, the Habsburg Empire and the British Empire, and all these were the dominant superpower in the world. It was very clearly the dominant superpower in the world, and now for a while it's been the United States, and yet this changes from time. Changing is the way that a society organizes itself does time to time. You know, these sort of systems are copied, you know, over and over again throughout the world, and it changes from is a very exciting time to be alive because we have a front row seat to go through all things all at the same time, everything happening now at the same time. We're in the early stages of the global financial system, a lot of turmoil and interesting consequences. We have stages of the dominant superpower in the world change, and that has very interesting consequences. We're in the very early stage. A, that a society organizes itself really is changing. We see a lot of evidence of that. Our technology has far surpassed, has completely leapfrogged over sort of the laws and the human constructs of our society. They just simply don't apply. In the past that's happened, whether it has been in the Industrial Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution or so forth, that's always created a change in the way that society organizes itself. We're at a point now where I'm sitting somewhere in the United States, and we're able to have a conversation over Skype and do a little. That's something that wasn't possible, even just a short time within our own lifetimes. It used to not really be possible, and now it is on a regular basis. What does that mean? Borders aren't really relevant anymore. Corporations exist on a global basis. You know, they're able to shift their taxation around from one place to another. Individuals can hop on a plane, you know, tomorrow and, you know, and then wake up tomorrow morning on the other side of the earth and yet still do business all over the world, and you can earn your money on the other side of the planet and so forth. Borders no longer matter, and we're eventually going to, you know, gravitate towards a new way of organizing our societies, the modern standards of technology. So all this really makes to me, I think, is an interesting time to be alive. There's a lot of changes and a lot of, you know, I think anytime there's significant change is usually turmoil, but I think if you can kind of see to really benefit from a lot of that, to me, I find that very exciting.
I'm with you, man. I could not imagine being alive at a different time at this point. I feel like I'm one of those people that was born to be here, and watch it all go down has just been it's mesmerizing. I mean, to watch the speed with which things are evolving in every arena, like technology, everything. It's just absolutely, the medical industry is going crazy right now. We seem to be at the forefront of so many different technologies that I agree are really going to rapidly rechange, you know, reshape the borders and reshape the world. But I think the most important aspect in all of this is, again, coming back to self-empowerment, being aware of your surroundings, being able to get access to quality information and be able to make decisions that are going to be good going forward. So, again, I want to promote, you know, sovereignman.com as a source for people to go and get information like that. So given the context of our conversation today, Simon, what do you think the most important things are that people should know if they are thinking about kind of taking this change on, where they're, you know, becoming more self-aware and more aware about society that they live in? They might be toying with the idea of becoming an expat. What are some of the initial things that these people need to be considering when they're starting to think down that road?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, one is to remember that there's basically nothing that's irreversible in this world. People have a lot of this and a little bit of anxiety done before. It sounds kind of spooky to have an offshore bank account or things like that. I mean, I'm here to tell you it's not really. It's all actually quite easy and simple, but you can do that's not undoable should you find out later in life that it just doesn't. But more importantly, I mean, just to kind of get back to a larger point with all this, I think is, the one thing I would really encourage everybody to do is just to educate themselves. I think that's the most important thing. To me, I think everyone is looking at this, and I think people instinctively feel deep down within them that something's just not right. They feel like it's not the country that they grew up in, or younger when they were kids, whatever, that, I mean, things just used to be different, and they don't like the way that it's changed. This can lead people down to something, you know, where they sort of have an initial moment, and maybe it's, you know, I know a lot of people have their aha moment when their wife or daughter getting fondled at an airport, you know, by some agent of the government.
Woo! Couldn't even imagine.
Their account frozen by a tax authority, or, I mean, anything like that that made, okay, wait a minute. Something's seriously wrong here. You know, something is seriously messed up, and it starts direction. And just like my own personal journey where I thought, wait a minute, they're lying about, you know, going, they're lying about, and that led me down this path. that path can lead to learning, you know, disconcerting information.
Yes.
Very, very quickly, where suddenly you realize, you know, wait a minute, you know, my country is completely, entirely insolvent.
Everything is fraud.
Analysis, right. They're telling me themselves, you know, the government accountability, single year that the U.S. government is entirely, completely insolvent. And, you know, and that can be really scary. And when people find out information that's very scary, that can lead to a certain level of fear.
Yes.
Fear is a funny emotion because fear can lead us to do irrational things. And so I would encourage folks to really spend a lot of time educating themselves so they can attack these problems from a position of strength, based on rational information, not based on irrational fear. Irrational fear causes us to make knee-jerk reactions and do things that are actually destructive, versus educating yourself, looking at options and solutions, actually really understanding the problems. You know, that's anybody can do because we all have different situations. You know, but it's really that idea of education, being able to approach things an educated position of strength that can make all the difference in the world.
I completely agree with that. Are you a proponent then of having people buy, you know, Black's Law's dictionaries and really start studying contract law and things like that? Or are you more just get your own ducks in a row and understand that the situation is just as bad as everyone thinks it is and start making a plan to get out?
Well, I think that's really up to the individual. I mean, my own, you know, take discovering what was out there. It's look, I'm a person. I have an abundance mentality. For me, is I've seen a tremendous amount of opportunity out there. As I left my home country, I left the United States, and I started traveling and spent a lot, you know, all my time overseas. I found that I've really increased my own level of freedom, decreased, you know, to the system and so forth. But more importantly, I've really been able to enrich myself with exposure to tremendous business, investment, and lifestyle opportunities. And so to me, you know, that approach, instead of being sort of, you know, completely defensive and a little bit negative minded and say, okay, how can I fight these guys in court? And how can I sort of, you know, break open this contract? And how can I sort of expose this and get this better or whatever, to, you know, trying to fight people and be defensive. To me, it's like, you know what, guys, your system for yourself, you know, you can keep your corruption and your war and your, you enjoy that. And I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to pick up and go somewhere else. You know, and that's really the thing, is because doing that was an incredibly freeing experience. And what I found is that instead of having to fight, you know, tooth and nail on my freedom, I just went to places where I didn't have to do that anymore. Where I can look out my window, you know, and see this beautiful vista and, you know, food and what, and just do whatever I want to do and not have to constantly look over my body about it.
It sounds like a paradise.
And that to me seems like a, you know, it really is, but I mean, everybody's got their own thing. I just, you know, to me, the, you know, the idea of instead of just, again, looking, try and fight and defend, just because as long as you're doing that, you're still sort of playing their game by their rules. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to fight against that and throw technicalities in the face. To me, I just, you know what, I'm just going to not play your game. I'm going to get up and you enjoy the rest of your game by yourself. I'm just not going to play.
Man, I like, that's like the most sensible response to that question that I've ever gotten. And I've got questions from the chat room now. Everybody wants to know how much it costs to live in Chile.
I mean, you know, to each his own. I would say, I mean, to me, this is, you know, this is, I mean, there's plenty of place in the world. One of the things that, you know, Chile is, to me, it's an inexpensive place. It's well developed. It's beautiful. You know, Chile is a long and skinny country. You know, the Chile's length goes from, if you can imagine, basically like, you know, Baja, central Baja, all the way up to southeastern Alaska. And so you get, basically you go through every single climate zone along the way.
Wow.
And so, I mean, with very Mediterranean, you know, I'm basically, you know, I'm in California.
Right.
You know, but without all the consequences in the day.
Yeah, the Californians.
you know, yeah, it's, I mean, I'm able to, you know, do things here. You know, you can buy, you know, farmland here for, I mean, I'm looking at I actually just sent one of my employees to go look at a property, nearby here that for less than $100,000, they're selling, I don't even remember, I want to say it was 25, 30 acres of land plus, that's in very good condition for less than $100,000. I mean, near a big town where you have, you know, hospitals and stores and all these things. I mean, you know, and when you look at, you know, why bother, you know, spending your life fighting and, you know, trying to defend, just say, you know what, guys, just forget it. You know, I'm done. I'm going to productive assets and my, you know, and my brain power, which is the most productive asset of all. And I'm going to just go somewhere else,
man.
You know, and you can live overseas and be, you know, do all these things and not have to fight. You know, suddenly, you know, so you not have to pay taxes from a moral perspective, but I mean, you know, the IRS itself will say, oh yeah, you're living overseas. We don't expect to even hear from you. You know, still able to earn money, abroad again. I mean, through all of our communication technology and so forth. And I mean, look, Chile's a great place for me. It might not be the best place for everybody. There's a whole world out there. And a ton of different opportunity and, you know, there's people, you know, expats living everywhere, very interesting people who are like, you know, friendly relationships with people, you know, all over the world. And it's just a better option than trying to, you know, again, sort of fight your way through life, police officers and so forth. You know, I don't, it just, it's not worth it. It's a lot easier to go through life and, you know, leave the children and the corruption, you know. I mean, they just, to me, that's what they act like. I mean, politicians are like bratty, spoiled wing and, you know, trying to bully people. It's just not going to play in the sandbox anymore. Go somewhere else.
I think that's the most reasonable.
It's a much better option.
I agree. So, okay, we've only got about a minute left. Give us your top five. I assume Chile is in there, but top five places people should be looking to expat if they want to do it.
Oh, I could never possibly answer that question. It's very unique,
okay.
You know, to individuals. I love Chile, obviously. You know, Colombia is an incredibly interesting place. In Europe, in the Pyrenees Mountains, sandwiched between France and Spain. Oh, God, gorgeous. Especially if you love skiing and very easy to become a resident.
Right.
Resident. You know, no list be complete without mentioning Thailand. You know,
really?
Cambodia. Oh, I mean, yeah, forget about it. I mean, the lifestyle is amazing. And look, the world is a big place. It's a ton of amazing. I mean, Ecuador. I mean, a lot of people living in Mexico, and for obvious reason, a lot of people living all over the Caribbean. I mean, different places across the world, places to be. And I would just encourage people to understand that you're not trapped in a system where you don't want to be. There's a better way.
Oh, I love it. Simon, thank you so much for coming on the show. That's probably the most empowering show that we've done here in a long, long time, brother. Thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Please, everybody, go check out solverman.com. Sign up for the newsletter. I'm telling you, you're going to get great information from him. I've already learned so much just from reading his stuff. Just absolutely amazing. Thankful for him to join us today. Tomorrow, Water Lily will be on. We'll be talking about encryption. We'll be talking about seenandunseen.is. Very looking forward to that conversation. So do stay tuned tomorrow and keep it here all day, guys. TFR, we're here for you. A lot of great hosts, a lot of good work being done here, and we want you guys to be a part of it. So thank you guys for being here. We will see you tomorrow.
Truth Frequency Radio is your number one source for news and information. Without the hate, hype, and fear, we are proud to bring you cutting-edge programs like The Kev Baker Show,
The Christopher Everard Show,
The Freedom Link with Joe Joseph,
Truth Frequency with Chris and Shuri Geo,
Red Pill Reports
with J.D. Moore,
X-Squared with Brooks Agnew,
Down the Rabbit Hole with Popeye,
Freaky Friday
with The Woo Crew,
Waking Up the Masses
with Robert Bruce,
Phoenix Rising Radio,
and dozens more.
Did you know you can listen from any computer, mobile device, or from any telephone by dialing 832-225-5308.
Or call into your favorite show toll-free at 866-37-TRUTH.
Uncensored talk and news you won't hear in the mainstream media.
24 hours a day.
Truth Frequency Radio. Wherever you are.
are. Make it TFR.
Truth Frequency Radio.